So today, I'd like to tell you a little bit about the Earth, Moon, and Mars. First, a preamble about magnetism in various forms, and then a visit to the blue planet, the gray planet, and the red planet. And along the way, let me pay tribute to my collaborators, Jaffer Arkani-Hamid, Özden Özdemir, and two friends of mine at NASA Goddard, Gin Kletechka and Mike Perucker. Well, to start at the beginning, ferromagnetism is due to spin. And electron spins have magnetic moments that are proportional to SZ and directed along the magnetic field. But the story of ferromagnetism is that these spins are not independent of each other, but rather are exchange coupled, a phenomenon discovered by Heisenberg back in the early days of the last century. And this creates a strong spontaneous magnetization. Spontaneous because you don't have to apply any field to produce it or to maintain it. Now, strong as exchange coupling is, and it really is strong, thermal energy eventually becomes stronger. If you heat up to a few hundred degrees, that will eventually destroy this coupling, and you go through a ferromagnetic to paramagnetic phase transition. On the other hand, if you cool from above the Curie temperature, which is the critical point for that phase transition, even a small magnetic field, as you cool through the critical point, will eventually give you, in room temperature, a thermal remnant magnetization, a TRM. Over longer distances, the spins remain lined up, but they subdivide their structure into what are called magnetic domains. This was discovered by Landau and Lifshitz in the middle 1930s. These regions of strong spontaneous magnetization, which you can actually, you can't see the domains themselves in this picture. What you see are the walls between domains, which are the places where the spins rotate from one orientation to another. And in magnetite, the directions for the MS vectors are along the 111 axes, so it forms a beautiful complete flux closure loop. These domains, just like MS itself, change with temperature, and as the temperature drops, you can see that domains enlarge or change in other ways. These domains that were at the edge propagate themselves across the crystal. This one didn't succeed. It died away. This nucleation and propagation was so successful that it had a second go at it with a domain of reverse magnetization penetrating into the original domain. The most stable recorders of all, and the things that are used, for example, inside this laptop to store the information, are things that lack domain walls. If you make a particle smaller than the width of a domain wall, down in the nanometer range, then there is only room for a single domain. That's extremely stable, and all sorts of organisms have taken advantage of this through their much longer evolutionary history. We haven't yet worked out ways of producing single domain particles which are of this quality, even with our technology. The most successful one of all is a very small critter, Aquaspirulum magnetotacticum. It feels its way along magnetically from place to place. And it produces these perfect magnetite octahedra. You see some examples here. Strings them together like beads into chains, which it uses as a compass needle. It tells it not actually how to go north and south, but how to go up and down, because this bacterium is mostly water, and it's neutrally buoyant. It can't use the gravitational field to tell up from down. Instead, it uses the magnetic field, which over most parts of the Earth is mainly vertical. It's bad news if they're taken from one hemisphere to the other, because then they go the wrong way. Now, the reason they use single-domain particles is because these particles do not self-demagnetize. If you have something that's strongly magnetic, it likes to get itself into a lower energy state by reducing the magnetization. You can't do that with a single domain particle. So in rocks, these Single domain particles give a very intense and stable TRM. Different minerals have different critical single domain sizes. Magnetite is the commonest mineral, but it's down in the nanometer range. 100 nanometers is its critical size, so it's a pretty restricted single domain range. Put some titanium in the lattice and you get a much larger size range. And hematite, which is common everyday rust, it's red iron oxide, is a very large single domain size. So all of this size range, which covers almost everything in rocks, is single domain. Let's move on to the magnetic field. The Earth's magnetic field is almost an ideal dipole. It might have been taken out of a third year textbook. The only thing that's not quite perfect about it is its axis is tilted a little bit, about 11 degrees. But even that cures itself over geological time because the axis precesses. So over about 10,000 years, we believe, anyway, paleomagnetists believe strongly because the success of their subject is based on the magnetic axis coinciding with the rotation axis, that it really does average out to a dipole. Notice the dipole is going southwards here because, after all, a north magnetic pole is attracted to a south magnetic pole, so the Earth's north magnetic pole is the south magnetic pole. How confusing. The intensity of the Earth's magnetic field is nowadays very well mapped out, not so well in the past. It was Gauss who first undertook the mapping of the Earth's magnetic field, encouraged the British government, among others, to set up magnetic observatories all over the Earth. The British had the most far-flung empire. Of course, he was interested in latitude coverage, and they went pretty well from pole to pole. Gauss invented spherical harmonics specifically to describe the Earth's magnetic field. So those of you who use multipole expansions in your work, thank Gauss and thank the Earth's magnetic field for that. If you do a multipole fit to the Earth's magnetic field, go up to about 10th harmonic and say, that's the field. Anything that's left, by definition, is abnormal or anomalous, an outlier of society. So you can work out a magnetic anomaly map for the Earth, things that are not quite normal. The most prominent anomaly fields on Earth are due to seafloor spreading, and they're found in the oceans. New seafloor is being created all the time in the midst of the oceans. The plates are thereby increased in size. They spread away from the center. Horrible things happen to them over in the Pacific. That's why it's hidden behind in the other hemisphere here. But where the plates are growing, they're also acquiring a magnetism. As the rocks cool from the Curie point, they acquire a TRM, which should be in here somewhere. Well, reversals of the field are recorded in the rocks somehow, and that gives us linear magnetic anomalies. Linear because they parallel the spreading ridges. And the source is remnant. It's TRM. The rocks are not very deep in the ocean crust, no more than 3 kilometers deep. When you go to satellite altitudes, and this particular satellite, MagSat, flew at 400 kilometers altitude, you have a filtering effect. So anything whose source size is much less than 400 kilometers basically gets blanked out. It's like trying to distinguish a speck of dust on the back wall of the room. You just can't resolve it. It's there, but you can't see it. So these seafloor spreading anomalies that are drawn in here can't actually be seen from satellites. What you do see are things with a broader scale size whose sources lie much deeper, maybe as much as 50 kilometers deep in the crust. Because the Earth has a strong present field, I mean strong in planetary terms, the anomaly field that you see over the Earth is mainly induced. That is, if you took the Earth's field away tomorrow, the anomalies would all disappear. They're not permanent. Something that comes out rather easily in the wash. The source of the anomalies are in the Earth's deep continental crust. The main magnetic mineral, we think, anyway, is magnetite present. These are deep crustal rocks which have been excavated from depth by geological processes. This particular terrain is in Manitoba, and it's about 1 to 3% of magnetite in these rocks. Let's look now at the gray planet with Earth off in the distance here. The first magnetic information that we got in any detail about the moon came from the Apollo 15 magnetometers. Apollo 16 also flew a magnetometer, unfortunately not in polar orbit. So we got the same information over and over and over again. The orbit did not precess. But what could be seen, and you certainly can't see the numbers yourself, but they're very small. They're about 1 nanotesla, so down thousands of times lower than the Earth's magnetic field. That's also the level of the present lunar field, so induced magnetization on the moon is nothing. Anything that you do see has to be due to an ancient magnetism preserved as a remnant magnetism. When you look at the near side of the moon, the previous slide was the far side, the anomalies are of similar size. You can see some huge impact basins up here. This is Imbrium, Mare Serenitatis. They have essentially no magnetic expression, although they have enormous gravitational expression since they're filled with lava, and the lava is much denser than the surroundings. We have somewhat better magnetic information now because Lunar Prospector covered the planet much more uniformly with its orbit. The curious thing is that the magnetic anomalies that we found 1998-1999 are still not very big. 25 nanoteslas is still down by a factor of 1,000 compared to the Earth's magnetic field. They occur in very specific places on the moon at the antipodes to the major impact basins. So if you go 180 degrees around the moon from Crisium, you find this anomaly. And if you go 180 degrees around from Imbrium, here's the Imbrium antipode, you find this anomaly, which does actually sit on top of another Mare, but it's believed that it's really Imbrium that controls this. So why would this happen? I was asked this at coffee time, and I have no answer except the hypothesis that's been put forward that the ejecta from the giant impacts were simply thrown halfway around the planet until they met the other ejecta, and there they all collided and came to rest. Now, of course, there are ejecta at all sorts of distances. The impact basins themselves are ringed by ejecta, but these are incoherently magnetized. They're individually strongly magnetic, but the blocks are tumbled in random orientations. Apparently, for some reason, they aren't tumbled randomly here. So we need another lunar mission, and we know where to go this time. To sum up about what's going on in the moon, the present-day lunar magnetic field is negligible. There's no induced magnetism. But the ancient moon, we know, had a field on the order of the Earth's present field about 4 billion years ago. That was early days in the Earth's history. But in the other planets, most of the action was going on in these very early times and almost nothing since. It's recorded by TRM in the Apollo 11 through 17 samples returned to Earth. As Derek said, I worked briefly on this material, and it was absolutely dreadful stuff to work with. The magnetic mineral involved is iron, because the moon has virtually no oxygen. And the problem is that iron has a very, very limited single-domain range, so almost everything is multi-domain. Its magnetic moment would change before your eyes as you looked at the magnetometer. So, like this astronaut, I gave up on those rocks. And we're now turning our sights to the red planet. Soon, I hope, have to keep the lab going at least another 3 years until some actual return samples come. Actually, the rovers are doing such a good job, I'm not sure we can really justify bringing anything back to our lab, but still it would be nice. Now, Mars, of course, has extreme topography because its gravity is so much lower than the Earth. So if you want to climb the highest peak on Mars, you've got quite a job ahead of you. The important structures that I'd like you to notice that we'll talk about later, though, are in the southern hemisphere, they are low-lying basins, and these are kilometers deep. These are really low. Here and here. Hellas and Argyre, and somewhere up just north of Hellas should be Acetus, but I can't spot it at the moment. Maybe this is it. Let's compare the magnetic anomalies of Earth and Mars, both viewed from the same altitude. Now, the data weren't taken at the same altitude, so the Martian data have been continued upwards to a standard 400-kilometer altitude. And you can see that the maps look very different. The first thing that strikes you about Mars is that most of it is not magnetic at all. No magnetic anomalies to be seen. The distribution here is very uneven over the planet, whereas over the Earth, it's really quite even. Everybody, everywhere on the Earth, has some local magnetic anomaly that they can boast about. But on most parts of the Moon, there's just absolutely nothing. And the haves live in this part of Mars, and they've got it all. What they have, if you just compare the scale bars here, this one goes out to about 20 nanoteslas. This one is going out to about 200 nanoteslas. They've got 10 times more than anybody on Earth has got. That, I think, was the biggest surprise of the Mars Global Surveyor mission. At least those of us who work in magnetism think that that justified the whole mission. Of course, every mission carries a magnetometer, but it's just one of those things you do because it's done. That, incidentally, is how plate tectonics was proven also, because on every DSDP expedition or voyage, you take along a magnetometer. It's just the done thing. And what you get on Mars actually looks a heck of a lot like the seafloor, except that the scale of these magnetic stripes is rather different. Here you have hundreds to thousands of kilometers in scale size. Actually, it's not surprising because you're scanning these things from altitudes of hundreds of kilometers. So if the finer scale stuff is there, you're not going to see it. We do need to survey closer to the planet's surface. So let's look at the part of the southern hemisphere which has the anomalies, and they're shown here as contours, whereas the colored things are elevation. You can see the anomalies not only do not correspond to the impact basins, nor to the Tharsis Bulge, which is a gigantic lava plateau. If anything, they seem to be trying to avoid these obvious areas of topography. So the giant impact basins are magnetically completely barren. There is a major geologic subdivision on Mars which runs roughly around the equator. This dichotomy line separates the northern plains, which are blanketed by younger volcanics, from the southern highlands, which are like the Canadian Shield, but even older. Everything in the south is rough topography, ancient highlands rocks. That's where the major basins are seen. They're probably present in the north, but simply blanketed over with lava. So, a time scale. Derek would certainly agree that you have to have a time scale on things, or you know nothing. Now, on Mars, the important time is the very old time, the Noachian. I'm not sure if it's named after Noah. If so, they've missed the time scale by about a factor of 10 to the 9th, I guess, at least 10 to the 9th. Anyway, it's very, very, very old, around 4 billion years. And everything younger basically is interesting to volcanologists, but not to people interested in the basic architecture of Mars. The major impacts were between 4.2 and 3 billion years. We know that from the Moon, where you have a tremendous history of impacts, and every impact is recorded. So by crater counting on Mars, comparison with lunar impact history, we get the comparative time scale. Hellas and Argyre basins are unmagnetized, and so we know that either the magnetic dynamo that produced Mars' magnetic field predated 4 billion years, or else it postdated 3 billion years, because it was not turned on during the time of the major impacts. So we have either an early dynamo I should say a dynamo is a feature of planetary cores. If you move a conducting fluid through an already existing magnetic field, you get charge separation. That's what a dynamo does. That charge separation leads to magnetic fields. So if you've got a little magnetic field, you can produce a lot of magnetic field. It's kind of like capitalism. You have to have a little bit to invest, and you can get great returns in the end. An early dynamo is what most people believe in because we have an actual sample from Mars' surface from this era. We have one sample from Mars of this age. So everything practically about Mars is predicated on a sample of one. You wouldn't think much of that in an undergraduate lab, but that's how science is done when you get out to the planets. Might as well be honest about it. Everything is based on Allen Hills, which is a mountain range in Antarctica, 1984-001, the first meteorite picked up that year, was a major winner. All the other Martian meteorites are much younger. So let's go back to this stripe-like pattern over Terra Sumerium, Terra Serenum, which is this area here. It looks as though there are stripe-like patterns. And this is really interesting, of course, because it suggests maybe there was seafloor spreading on Mars. It would be very, very early seafloor spreading. There certainly aren't any seas there at the moment. These are the raw data that came back from the Mars Global Surveyor tracks, and it was instantly recognizable in 1999 from these raw data that there was something pretty stripe-like there. The strength of it, of course, was a major surprise. This scale here is without precedent from satellite missions around the Earth. This looks more like the outer planets in the solar system. And my colleague, Jaffer Arcani-Hamid, in fact, phoned up the people at Goddard and said, "Are you sure you had the magnetometer on the scale that you think you did?" And they said, "Yes, we checked. They're really that big." So are there magnetic stripes? Could there be ancient crustal spreading on Mars? Well, of course, there are differences. The stripe widths are hundreds of kilometers, the ones that we can resolve from space. Stripe lengths as long as 2,000 kilometers without any transform faults offsetting them. And a field magnitude, which is absolutely astonishing. To produce this field magnitude at this altitude, you need a source thickness of 30 kilometers, that is virtually the whole of the Earth's crust, magnetized at 20 amps per meter. Those silly SI units that don't mean anything to anybody. But you need a kilo of them, a kiloamp per meter, before they amount to a hill of beans. 1 kiloamp per meter is about what hematite will give you in the laboratory, and hematite isn't very magnetic. But this is still astonishing in a rock because there isn't all that much magnetic material in a rock. The only thing on Earth that's that magnetic is mid-ocean ridge basalt when it first comes out of the seafloor. And it doesn't stay that magnetic for long. So how do you produce a crust composed 100% of the most magnetic stuff that we know on Earth? The answer is I don't know, and nobody knows, but it's a wonderful thing to speculate about. So maybe Mars had a large magnetic field about 4 billion years ago. Maybe Mars' lithosphere has unusual magnetic mineral concentrations. Certainly, we would expect the Curie temperature has to be high so that it must be down deep in Mars' lithosphere. Otherwise, there just wouldn't be 30 kilometers of it. And the minerals that are producing it clearly must be reasonably strongly magnetic. At least they have to have an intense TRM. So let's look at those things one by one. Mars probably did have an internal dynamo field soon after accretion. Why? Everybody else had one, so why wouldn't Mars have one as well? Even the Moon, which is so small that it barely differentiated a core, managed to have a dynamo field, or at least something that produced reasonable magnetic anomalies at the surface. And our old friend Allen Hills 84001 does record a field if that field actually dates from this time, if. And the field somewhere in the range, I mean, even for a first-year lab, those are pretty broad limits, somewhere between 5 and 50, and the limits are determined by the lab. So the individual limits are quite tight, but if you're in a different lab, then you get a different number, which is rather suspicious. Anyway, not very strong fields, not unusually strong for the solar system. So how much magnetic mineral content could we possibly force into the Martian crust based on what we know about Martian meteorites and just the general composition of the Martian surface, what we can see from spectroscopy? Certainly not more than 10% by weight, which would be at least three times what's in the Earth's deep crust. So nothing special. Calculations on a stagnant lid overlying a convecting mantle and so on yield about a 30 kilometer thick early magnetic lithosphere. Oh, the curves here are not only faint, they're actually non-existent. There were model curves here, and Jaffer Arkani Hamid produced them, so he's going to be pretty upset to hear they disappeared. But anyway, he's published them, so they are in print. And what they would show, if they were still here, is that in the early days, in the first...
Turn off the background light.
Well... Yes, okay, something is very, very, very faint there. In the early history of Mars, only about the top 20 to 30 kilometers was above the Curie point of magnetite, which is about the highest Curie point that you can deal with. Nowadays, Mars is much cooler at the surface, and the magnetic lithosphere may be as much as 150 kilometers deep. But that's no odds, because in the early history, Mars was hot at the surface, and you really can't push it any deeper than 20 to 30 kilometers. So we need the whole darn crust being magnetic. Which mineral should we look at? A lot of people like pyrrhotite. The iron geochemistry is such that pyrrhotite, rather than pyrite, which is the more perfect iron sulfide, is favored in the Martian crust, and pyrrhotite, unlike pyrite, is magnetic. It's found in many SNC meteorites. That's just a term for meteorites that come from Mars. But pyrrhotite has some drawbacks. It's not nearly as magnetic as magnetite, six times less magnetic. Its Curie temperature is half as high as magnetite, so you're down by a factor of about 10, but an order of magnitude less favorable than magnetite. Another reason for being interested in pyrrhotite is that there are these basins which are completely shock demagnetized. Presumably these areas were originally magnetized, like the adjacent crust in here, but they got demagnetized because they were hit by a giant bolide. The pressure contours here are in gigapascals, 642 gigapascals, going out from the basin, and the thermally reset areas are just in the center here, but the shocked regions go out much farther. And the demagnetization seems to be related more to shock than to temperature. Pyrrhotite has a phase transition to a non-magnetic phase at about 3 gigapascals, and that's approximately where the boundary of the demagnetization lies. So there's some evidence that might favor pyrrhotite. Now, magnetite is the easiest mineral because, first of all, it's found everywhere on Earth. It's the most common magnetic mineral that you'll find. It's strongly magnetic, has a high Curie point, has the right isotherm on early Mars. There's even a way of producing it, which I think is quite ingenious. Mike Fuller, who's one of the co-authors here, has been doing science longer, I think, even than Derek and Gordon. And he's still going out on ODP cruises and dredging up samples from the bottom, well, actually drilling samples from the bottom of the ocean and working on it. It shows science is a very good thing for your health. You just can't get it out of your blood. You just keep doing it. So how do you get magnetite by this model? First of all, you precipitate siderite, which is an iron carbonate, out of carbon dioxide-rich fluids percolating through presumably the upper part of Mars crust. Then you heat by intrusions from below, lots of heat coming up. That decomposes siderite into magnetite, and the carbon dioxide comes off quite explosively at the same time. Third step, you start flushing water through here. The lowlands in the north are literally 10 kilometers lower than the highlands in the south. And so when you flush enough water through, you dissolve everything out, leaving the northern plains non-magnetic and the southern highlands, part of them, magnetic. It's kind of a neat model. Trouble is, you can't get a thick enough layer, I don't think, by this model. Now, as a physicist, you know, I really like a model that looks like this. It's really complicated, and it gets published in Nature. If you can get something that looks complicated and it's novel and it can be applied to Mars, it's going to make it into Nature. This is called lamellar magnetism. It's something that occurs at the interfaces between hematite, red rust, and ilmenite, which is very titanium-rich rust, and it's not red. It's not even ferromagnetic. At the interface, you get something that has the happy property of being as magnetic as magnetite, practically. Well, I lie. It's about 10% magnetite, but an awful lot more magnetic than hematite. But it's somehow coupled, exchange-coupled, very strongly coupled to the hematite, so that it has the same coercivity as the single-domain hematite, but it's 25 times more magnetic, or at least 25 times, 50 times more magnetic. How's that for having your cake and eating it too? It's a nice model, but of course nobody knows if it really happens. Nobody's measured this experimentally. This is a theoretical physics invention, so we'll see if it actually works. Now, hematite, on the face of it, is a very unlikely candidate for Mars because it's just not very magnetic. 2.5 kiloamps per meter. The kilo kind of sounds as though it's big, but a kiloamp per meter is not actually very big. These SI units are all ridiculous because one Tesla for B is so big it's through the roof, and one amp per meter is so small that you can hardly detect it. I'm exaggerating a bit, but I mean, why would you choose B and H units, which are separated by mu naught, which is a factor of 4 pi times 10 to the minus 7, so that's a million? Why would you choose units like that when you had a perfectly good Gauss and Oersted named after people who actually did something? I mean, what did Professor Amp per meter ever do for you? So a kiloamp per meter is nothing to write home about. So on the face of it, hematite is just not in the running, like the Toronto Argos. So why consider hematite at all? Well, Mars is the red planet. Why is Mars red? Because its surface is covered with hematite. Large concentrations of hematite. Not only that, but they're in the right grain size range. They're single domain. They're just what we would like for a stable magnetization. Now, they're mainly found in Sinus Meridiani, but, you know, the whole planet looks pretty red. So there's lots of hematite around on the surface. By contrast, we think magnetite and pyrrhotite are there, but we don't actually know it for sure. In the thermal emission spectra from the surface, we don't see magnetite and pyrrhotite. Well, finally, you thought I'd never get to any work that I'd actually done myself, but here we are. And this is the sort of stuff that you do in the lab. It's not quite as exciting as what gets published in Nature, but never mind. If you look at the various candidates, magnetite and hematite are the ones considered here in a field of about the strength of the Earth's magnetic field, assuming that's what Mars had in the early days. Single-domain magnetite wins. Not surprising. What is astonishing is that multi-domain hematite, containing domain walls, is actually quite strong if you pick just the right field to look at, whereas single-domain hematite is quite weak. So it's totally non-intuitive, and this happens because multi-domain hematite has the happy property of not self-demagnetizing. If you're weak and puny, sometimes it has some good effects. One effect is you don't get swamped by your own magnetism. You don't self-demagnetize. So maybe we shouldn't consider single-domain hematite at all, but Usden and I think that you should, because when single-domain hematite is measured with the right samples, then you get something that's much stronger than anybody previously believed. Now, I mean, how does this happen? How do I pull out of a drawer a hematite that suddenly doesn't behave like previous hematites? Hematite in nature is mostly produced as a secondary product. The primary products are iron hydroxides, which form kind of a skin of weathering over most sediments. When they dehydrate, they give hematite, but they don't give nice big single crystals of hematite. They give polycrystalline, cryptocrystalline material whose grain size is so small that it hardly carries any magnetism. So people have been measuring the wrong hematite. And what we find is that maybe hematite, single domain hematite, actually will work. Now, magnetite and hematite behave in diametrically opposite ways. As you look to larger grain size in magnetite, you get less and less TRM. When you look to larger grain sizes in hematite, you get more and more TRM. So that's kind of surprising. I'm not going to explain all the physics behind this, but that's the way it is. We started out with a shopping list, if you like. Went to the store and we looked on the shelves to see where we could find 30 kilometers worth of material with 20 amps per meter of magnetization on the label of the box. And there aren't many boxes in the supermarket with the appropriate label. Single domain magnetite would work, and you would only need a percent or less of it, but all of the magnetite would have to be very, very, very small. The bacteria know how to do it. The birds and bees know how to do it. Even salmon know how to do it. It helps them find their way back to where they were spawned. But does Mars know how to do it? Probably not. Single domain pyrrhotite, you only need 1% to 2%, but again, it's pretty restrictive in grain size. It's also restrictive in the depth of the Curie point isotherm. Multi-domain hematite, you can do it with that too, with a couple of percent, but you need very large sizes, greater than 20 microns, and it probably isn't stable for 4 billion years. You always have to worry about stability. This stuff's been around for a long, long time. You wouldn't expect to come back, even to a nice new laptop like Sabine's here, and find that all of your information was uncorrupted 10 years from now. In fact, probably it would be so old you wouldn't be able to even access the information. But in the hard drive, things would have changed a little bit. Give it 4 billion years, and it's going to have changed a whole lot. So you do have to worry about long-term stability. I do mean long-term. Hemolymite lamellae, if we ever find that they actually have the right magnetic properties, about 3%. Anyway, lots of candidates, but who knows if any of them can really compose essentially the entire upper crust of Mars. That's a heck of a lot of material. Now, some magnetic questions. How long did it actually take to block TRM? Remember, crustal rocks don't just cool overnight. It's not like a lava flow coming out on Hawaii. It engulfs a few people's houses, then it cools off after having burned everything up. And next month, you can actually walk on it. It's cooled. But the whole crust of Mars isn't like that. It would take about 10 million years cooling time to get through this blocking temperature range of magnetite. These contours, actually, are at least the 95 and 5% blocking limits, are something that Derek York produced a long time ago. Well, Mars dynamo and global field likely endured for at least 100 million years, so this is fine because almost all blocking temperatures are in this narrow range at high temperatures. No problem putting the TRM in. Will it last? Will it stay fresh? What's its shelf life? Is it going to be 4 billion years? Is it best before 2 billion years, or will it last for 3, or will it last for 4? This is another one of these time temperature diagrams. This one shows two different minerals, magnetite and pyrrhotite, but the contours that are important are the ones for magnetite up at high temperature. This time, we're not going to worry about how fuzzy this curve is, how wide it is, but rather, if you go from 10 million years to 4.5 billion years, how much does your blocking temperature change? It only changes by 10 to 15 degrees. So if you can cool by that amount before the magnetic field turns off, before the dynamo dies, then you have preserved things, in theory anyway, for the next 3.5 billion years. So the conclusions are that we have minerals that are possible as carriers of the field, with probably magnetite being the likeliest, just because you'll need the least of it, but hematite being also possible. All the minerals have deep Curie point isotherms in the early history of Mars. There's no problem putting the TRM in. Maybe there's a problem preserving it long enough, but even that is perhaps okay. The big problem is really explaining the architecture of Mars' crust, how you construct 30 kilometers of all the same material, all extremely magnetic. Now, if I were a conventional speaker, I've shown my conclusions and I'd stop, but you're still not completely asleep. So let's go on and do something exciting and look at the question of life on Mars. And after all, this is what is driving Martian exploration. Let's not kid ourselves. It's not being driven by science. It's being driven by George Bush and questions like this. I mean, if George says no, then it stops. So we want to take these things seriously. So was there ever spring on Mars? Is there life now on Mars? If so, how did it survive the conditions on Mars, which are not... It's pretty bad outdoors today, but, oh boy, on Mars, the daily temperature range is extreme. Was there once life there, and did it perish under these harsh conditions? If so, did life on Earth come from Mars or somewhere else in the solar system? This is a hypothesis called transpermia, leapfrogging life from one planet to another using meteorites. Well, the first question, how could anything live without an atmosphere? And Mars lost its atmosphere very early on. The only protection you have from cosmic ray bombardment is the magnetic field. Horizontal magnetic fields are a magnetic umbrella. They do this for cosmic ray particles on Earth. They send them off to the poles where we see the aurora. If we didn't see the aurora, those particles would be being dumped on us, which is not a good thing. On Mars, there are only these few areas that have large magnetic fields, but maybe those might have harbored life. That's, of course, not where the rovers are looking, but maybe we should send the rovers to those locations to have a look. Even more, this gets increasingly speculative, so if you're bothered by speculation, you better leave now. Life on Mars 4 billion years ago, is there magnetite in Allen Hills 84001, our one and only one sample, which could have been produced by living organisms? Well, here's 84001, Allen Hills magnetite, crystals extracted. Here are crystals of similar size, so the scale bars are about the same size, extracted from a magnetotactic bacterium, strain MV1. And they do look fairly similar, but then, of course, magnetite likes to crystallize this way, so nobody can ultimately prove that these crystals are somehow related to early life. But a lot of people believe it nonetheless. In the spring, you're going to have Ben Weiss here as a colloquium speaker, so he'll tell you all about this story, but I'll just scoop a little bit of it by saying that he and others have used a scanning squid magnetometer. That is a magnetometer that actually uses squids as the field detection device. And a squid can count, using a Josephson junction, can count individual flux quanta. You don't get more sensitive than that. So this is a pretty good scanner. What we're looking at here are essentially magnetic anomalies over something the size of your hand. This is only part of the meteorite. The fusion crust here that was melted as the meteorite came through the Earth's atmosphere is here, and it has a walloping great magnetic anomaly. What we're really interested in is the interior, which itself has lower amplitude anomalies, but they are pretty interesting because if you heat this meteorite only 40 degrees, and that's what you see on the right here, some of the original anomalies actually change. This one here is practically gone. This one down here is completely gone. So the features change with only 40 degrees of heating. I mean, you might have dropped it into a pot of water that hadn't even come to the boil, and the magnetic signal has changed. Does that mean that this meteorite's interior had actually never before been heated to 40 degrees? That's the question. I'll leave it till the spring term colloquium to answer it. But if Weiss and others are correct about this, then it could mean that bacteria could actually hop from planet to planet. You might think it incredible that a meteorite could be ejected from the surface of Mars with enough energy to reach the Earth, go through the Earth's atmosphere, have its surface melt, and yet have a cool interior. But thermal conduction is very, very, very slow. It is conceivable. There are carbonates actually preserved in here, so this thing certainly hasn't been heated all that high. These carbonates are still recognizable. So more conclusions, speculations more than conclusions. Maybe a magnetic umbrella sheltered Martian life forms from destruction. And maybe Martian meteorite, Allen Hills 84001, contains 4-billion-year-old biogenic magnetite. Thank you.
Are there some questions? Do we have some questions?
Yes. It seems to me that you do have to have this kind of a shelter from cosmic rays. Then what really matters is whether you have a magnetospheric like interaction or not. In other words, if your dipole magnetic field of the same existing magnetic field, was it strong enough to stand off the solar wind?
Well, it's the magnetosphere that was, not the magnetosphere that now is. And the nice thing about the surface is that we have the magnetic record, but we don't have a record of the magnetosphere. Do you have any comments on that, Sabine? So I'm sorry, I can't answer it, really.
Sorry, there was a gentleman there. Yeah. I don't want to substitute a light question, but considering the magnetic candidates you have, magnetite, rovers say at any rate, is ubiquitous to dust. And I'm pretty sure, the dust is less than a micron size. So I'm just wondering if that has any bearing on your candidates, because you have single main, multi-main magnetite. But I don't think that
It's true that the magnets on the rovers have now picked up material which has been identified as magnetite. To call it ubiquitous, I wouldn't say so. It's certainly not ubiquitous in the sense that hematite is ubiquitous. You don't see its thermal emission spectrum, for example. So it's there in small quantities on the surface, but it's not common in the way the hematite is. Of course, we don't, in a sense, care what's on the surface. What we care about is what's at depth in the lithosphere. That's probably a totally different question. The hematite on the surface is probably all secondary. Well, I'm going to let Sabine answer that. That's
Venus, the surface is too hot. There are no magnetic problems associated with it. Ganymede has no magnetic field due to the dynamo. Mercury might have a crust of field below.
So you're something.
Well, the giant planets have giant fields.
Yes.
But, of course, being liquid helps. The stony planets, that's a little harder. Most meteorites, which you know are asteroidal fragments, are fairly strongly magnetic. So we have remnants of those stony bodies.
Yes.
How do they know that the meteorite came from Mars?
Well, in two ways. First of all, from the elemental composition, which matches that you can see spectroscopically from the surface. Again, you sense the surface, you don't really sense the depth. Secondly, because there are gas inclusions in some of these meteorites which have trapped atmosphere, and now with the descent of the rovers, during the descent, the atmosphere was sampled and it is a good match. So that was pretty convincing verification. Yeah, it's one kind of wonders, since the trajectories are so wildly improbable, how you could ever scoop up any of this material.
The strength of remnant magnetism in all the SNC materials are the same order, or
in all of
the SNC meteorites?
Oh no. They're a very mixed bag. Just as you would expect, you know, if you went out on Earth and wore a blindfold while sampling rocks, you get gabbroic, basaltic, and you get every kind of composition. And even within a class of SNC, you know, if you just stick to the S is shergotite, the Shergotti meteorites, the type of that, you get natural remnants, which maybe TRMs, that vary by a factor of 10,000 from one to another. Although for an individual meteorite in a strewn field, even though it may have been fragmented a great deal, Shergotti itself, all the fragments have approximately the same amount. So it's homogeneous within a meteorite, but rather different from one to another. There are only about 30 to 35 of these Martian meteorites known.
If not, I'd like to thank you again very much and hope you'll enjoy your non-retirement.
Thanks. And by the way, no need to take out the library copy. There's a paperback edition for $50 US at the AGU meeting. You can get a 20% discount.